listening to Talking Architecture, a weekly podcast on architectural narrative, buildings, and the stories they tell. In this season, we're bringing you the Venice Biennial of Architecture, with weekly guests representing national pavilions. I'm your host, Anthony Youssef, and joining me this week are three of the co-curators of the Australian Pavilion, Ali Baker, Julian Worrall, and Sarah Rhodes. Ali is an associate professor at Flinders University and a multidisciplinary artist who is a member of the Unbound Collective, a group of First Nation artists academics. Julian is a professor of architecture and the head of the University of Tasmania School of Architecture and Design. Sarah is a photographic artist using a post-documentary practice to explore ways in which the external environment shapes the inner world. Along with Anthony Koop and Emily Peach, Ali, Julian, and Sarah co-curated the pavilion, exploring the concept of decolonization on both local and global scales through the exhibition Unsettling Queenstown. We spoke about the exhibition and the relationship of settler colonialism, extraction, and sustainability. Julian, Ali, Sarah, thank you for joining me today. You are three of the co-curators of this year's exhibition at the Australian Pavilion at the Venice Biennial of Architecture. Your exhibition is titled Unsettling Queenstown, and it aims to draw attention to the legacy of colonialism and extraction. Now, at first glance, it seems your focus is on one particular town, but that's in fact not the case. Can you elaborate on the title of the exhibition and how it reflects its premise?
Thank you very much, Anthony. It's great to be here. The title, Unsettling Queenstown, really draws attention to the legacy of colonialism in specific places, and we use Queenstown as both a specific site with its concrete aspects, landscapes, experiences, histories, populations, and so on, but at the same time as a model or a template for colonialism globally. Indeed, it was the case that the specific example of Queenstown in Tasmania was our initial inspiration. And the story of that particular place carried so much resonance with the intentions and the agenda of the Biennale as a whole to understand or engage with the environmental and human legacies of colonialism, and the necessity to question that and to unsettle that, and then to reimagine a positive future. But we quickly discovered that there were many Queenstowns around the world, and indeed another Queenstown in Australia, in South Australia, where three out of our five curatorial team are based. So the materials that you see in the show, the visual materials and the stories and the interviews and so on, are drawn from those two places in Australia, two specific places, and they both have legacies of environmental destruction and dispossession of First Nations people. So that similarity is evident in bringing those two towns to bear.
You alluded to a bit about the sort of features of the exhibition, and we'll get to that in detail in a bit, but I'd be curious to sort of look a bit more closely and do a closer reading at the title. And part of that is unsettling. And I think what, the way I see it at least, is part of that is a sort of reference to perhaps a counter-colonialism or a call to action against colonialism. But I'm wondering also, how much does it speak to what your exhibition aims to do in terms of disrupting traditional practices? And perhaps that's a question to Ali.
Thanks, Anthony. I think part of our conversations, which were long leading into this project and the installation in Venice, was really considering the kind of impact of colonialism as a series of kind of maneuvers that continue into the present, and very much a kind of like Ann Stoller describes them, Laura Ann Stoller describes them as this kind of like waves that come crashing in and then recede and then crash in. But ultimately what's happened globally, and I'm sitting in the middle of a settler colonial city in a settler colonial country, where the settlers have come and not left. And part the cartography, the renaming, the kind of mapping and the kind of infrastructure and institutions that came with colonialism, the Biennale was really asking us to consider issues relating to justice and sustainability. And that requires us to look back but also look forward. So to consider how those institutions of colonialism have benefited some groups of people and not benefited others, but also in this country for Aboriginal people, particularly in South Australia on Kaurna Yatta, Indigenous peoples here have not benefited from the legacies or the contemporary practices of colonialism. And so we were interested in our community's understandings of what change might look like, how change came to Kaurna country, Adelaide, which is, and so we were focused on a particular area of Port Adelaide, where in 1836, South Australia is different to the rest of the country in that it was a province, and you could buy like plots of land sight unseen from England. And Torrens Title comes out of here, this kind of dematerialization of land from its own histories. And that has, in a sense, spread globally in terms of kind of how land can be disassociated from its own history. And, you know, at the basis of architecture, we are located. So we have to locate these knowledges, but at the same time, the issues relating to colonialism are very much about how they're universalized, how these ideas could be applied here, they could be applied in Europe, they could be applied, well, throughout the kind of colonized world, Africa, the Americas. You can find Queenstowns anywhere, but there are other names for these places. And I guess part of what decolonization might look like, or what unsettling might look like, is actually peeling back the layers of what has occurred in that place, understanding why they happened, how we can measure justice in relation to those things, and trying to, I guess, redesign our institutions and our communities to provide some kind of reparation, which can be an emotional reparation as well as a physical and financial one. It's as much about the kind of culture of how we understand ourselves in country, on country, and what are we going to do about the kind of greed and extractionism that's happening globally? How are we going to, it's a collective problem. So that they were the big kind of philosophical things. And then we really looked closely at specific places. We asked our elders, we asked miners, loggers, you know, we asked a range of people. And Sarah and I had the honour of interviewing various Aboriginal elders from Lutra Witta, Tasmania, and Kaurna Yatta, who were based in Port Adelaide, which is also called Yatta Bolte, place of sleep. But the place of Queenstown was actually where the settlers first arrived. They saw the mangroves as being like a miserable, muddy place, and they called it Port Misery to begin with. So they didn't see our country as beautiful. They didn't see it as, they saw it as a place that they wanted to cover over and bring, make it like England. Name it like England, make it look like England, and that what we, who we were as Aboriginal people, and our beautiful country wasn't seen as beautiful in the way of the English kind of refined garden type, you know. So these are kind of interesting resonances from that. Yeah. I don't know if I've answered the question. I've spun a
No,
bit of a tangent.
definitely.
Yeah.
No, and that's a great segue to my next question, because obviously one of the most kind of evident ways to make these sort of what they believed as being newly discovered places to make them look like England, it was through architecture. And a prominent feature in the exhibit is the reconstruction of the Empire Hotel in Queenstown. So I'm curious to know if you can talk to us a bit why you chose to focus on this building and sort of what it has to say in terms of colonialism.
Yeah, the Empire Hotel really centers the town of Queenstown, the settlement of Queenstown in Lutruwita, Tasmania. It's the most prominent building in the town. It was built in 1901, which is the year that Australia as a state came into existence with its federation of the colonial states. It has a grand appearance, particularly on it's a two-story hotel structure, and its second upper level is fronted by a arched loggia type structure, or belvedere, a semi-outdoor space for taking a view, and the view is of the town and also of the landscape of the mountains. So in that sense, it's a kind of a machine for surveying the landscape, a device for in a way visually controlling the land. And so that aspect of it was potent to begin with. It is indeed very symbolic and important in the town's physical landscape, and of course its history. It is also doubly, I think, ironic or fascinating that the name of the hotel is the Empire Hotel, especially given it was built during at the time of Federation, when Australia formally came into existence as an independent state. So this structure then began to serve all kinds of meanings. So it became a kind of receptacle to carry a variety of symbolic or semantic payloads in the exhibition. Indeed, my own experience of seeing this structure, I mean, we worked it through as part of the process. We explored different ways it might have been built, or it might appear, what it might mean. But in the space itself in Venice, in its final form, just for the listeners who maybe don't have an image of it to mind, it is an arched structure which turns a corner, and it's reconstructed in Venice out of copper tubing, just standard tubing that you might have in the plumbing of your house, 12 millimeter copper tubing. Copper is the material that Queenstown mined, and what brought Queenstown into existence and gave it its wealth. So there's a direct linkage there in material terms. The structure is rendered as an outline, essentially like a three-dimensional wireframe. It's not quite full scale. We couldn't fit the full size of it in the space of the pavilion, but it's about 70% of the size of the actual real Belvedere. As you enter the space, it divides the roughly square space of the pavilion into two zones. As behind the pavilion, as you look through it, is this very immersive projection wall, with moving imagery of the landscape of Queenstown in both South Australia, Gunyatta, and in Queenstown, Lutruwita, Tasmania. So it invites you in. You're taking a view through to the landscape through the structure in that way. And as you then go into the structure and turn around, you also take a view back to where you came from. And it's at that point that you begin to see another component of the exhibition, which is the open archive. So it's working as a viewing device in the exhibition itself, as well as it does in the town. It's floating above the floor, it's suspended. It doesn't actually touch the ground. So in that sense, it also has a kind of somewhat ghost-like or dreamy quality. It feels somewhat alien or mysterious. And literally, it's unsettled, doesn't have a foundation. As you look at this structure, it's evident that it's a fragment of a building, but it's also not clear at what point in the story of place that fragment might represent. It could, for example, represent the design of a place, a projection forward, as the colonists had a aspiration towards, creating a New England on this foreign land. It could also represent a memory of it, a looking back or a kind of a residue from the past. It could be a ruin, indeed. And ultimately, it is this quality of it being a kind of haunted, a haunting of the space, a haunting of place, of territory, of the land, that has driven our naming of the piece, which is the ghost, the Belvedere ghost. And I think for me, this is how it really most strongly configures the experience of the material in the exhibition, and indeed the whole meaning of the show for me is that that the colonial design, the colonial pattern of life, relation to people, relation to land, the planet, is something that haunts us, all of us. And it's not something we can escape, we can question, query, but it is in a way shaped us and built us. So that haunting is, I think, maybe what, I think would be its principal capacity or valence in this show, and which people could, I hope, almost at an unconscious or visceral level, retain and remember, even after all of the, the verbiage disappears.
Yeah, Julian, you did mention some of the projections that are featured sort of in tandem or parallel to the copper reconstruction of the Empire Hotel. But Sarah, I'm wondering if you can talk to us a bit more in detail about these projections and how they function in relation to the copper reconstruction.
Oh, thanks, Anthony. There are two video works to make the projection. There's one called Permeate that Unbound Collective made, who Ali Baker's part of. And I made the other film called Inhale, Exhale. I'll let Ali describe the Permeate in a minute, but I'll just explain the Inhale, Exhale. So, well, Permeate's based in Queenstown, Port Adelaide, and Inhale, Exhale is based in Queenstown, Lutruwita, Tasmania. And it's a soul search. It's like a personal journey through the landscape. It takes a individual perspective of our connection to place rather than Ali's film, which is more about a community connection to place. And it's takes a you look through the windscreen of a car and you're driving through the road, and it's like a soul search, and you're going through underground into the subterranean, into this tunnel, and it's this way of really connecting to where you are as a way of going inside yourself. And the idea is, well, first of all, you're moving through this haunted landscape. It's a landscape in recovery. It's been decimated really by the acid rain from the copper mining, from the sulfur, and it's sort of surviving 100 years on. And so there's sort of a parallel between you know, the inner self and how we can rejuvenate, as well as how the landscape can rejuvenate. But one of the main ideas is the importance of listening and connecting and understanding where you are and how that relates to architecture or any discipline, really, is the idea that you should, or ideally, just be attuned to the world around you and not sort of put your own ideas onto something, but actually listen to the communities around you, the First Nations people around you, the animals, the you know, what repercussions your decisions are having on other people, not just on yourself. Now, the copper, the Belvedere, it was quite amazing when we put the films on the and the Belvedere went up, that's made out of the copper pipe, as Julian said. It was as if, I mean, it's kind of obvious once you think about it, because the copper, not that copper specifically, wasn't mined in Queenstown because the mine's closed at the moment, but it was a copper mining town. And so the landscape is actually the colour of the Belvedere. Like when the Belvedere went up, it's really, it looks like they're married, that they're supposed to be together. So that was a really beautiful aspect of the exhibition. But Ali, do you want to talk a little bit about your film?
Yeah, just reflecting on what you were speaking about, Sarah, I was thinking about the kind of the aspect of kind of that contrast between extractivism and a particular kind of wealth generation, which comes from mining, which comes from a kind of a plundering of country, which is a measure of colonialism, that the tall ships were sailing around trying to find resources to take, you know, and you can see the evidence of those resources and the wealth that's been collected from the rest of the world in Venice. It was quite, in a way, important that we brought this, you know, that Leslie Loco asked this question in Venice, where you can see hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of this kind of particular kind of wealth generation that comes from a particular valuing. And for me, it's also gendered. So I look at the line drawing of the Belvedere and the imposition of buildings on country, which are formal and feel like this idea of mining, and it almost has the symbolism of it is very much about a kind of a white father patriarchy in this country at the moment. The last traces of the blue collar worker are the miners, right? You know, the last, but at the same time, we are at this point on the planet where this is unsustainable. We all know this. The scientists are telling us it's unsustainable way forward. It's not a way forward. And the lack of emotional connection that people are having, a long-term emotional connection to the places that they live, the histories, the violence, the injustice, the form, the breath, how we understand our existence is very vulnerable. We are all vulnerable. We will all die. There is no such thing as permanence. It is ephemeral, and it's changing all the time. Life changes. So this kind of falling of an empire, or the falling of the planet, or however we want to view it, is also can be seen. So the Belvedere is floating, and we started listening to a little talk by Eve Tarp called, it's a keynote address that she gave called "I Do Not Want to Haunt You, But I Will." She's a really important Native Canadian academic, and this idea of kind of how we understand change. So the Belvedere is floating there, haunting us, whether we want it or not. This is the legacy. And underneath is the kind of fallen leaves of, it's almost like, you know, and of this eucalyptus that makes the place smell. It gives it this very Australian sense of smell. And then through the Belvedere, you're seeing an emotional response, which is about the breath. So on Ghanaiyata, our film was really looking at the kind of rapid pace of soda ash production, which came from these salt fields, which were a series of kind of salty lakes that came down the coast of Ghana country, coast of South Australia, and produced soda ash, which is used in everything, plastic, concrete, paint. And the kind of production of this could have been sustainable and was for a little while. And then they lost control, the last person lost control of the kind of saline brine and released it into the last little conservation of mangroves on Kaurna country. And what we now know about these mangroves, which the colonists saw as miserable and ripped half of most of them out to produce really short-sighted suburbs like West Lakes, which is just was built on a mangrove swamp. It's sinking. It's foul architecture, if you ask me. But it took away what was the largest mangrove forest in the Southern Hemisphere. And the ecologists tell us that mangroves, every fourth breath we take is because of the fish nurseries and the oxygen produced, the carbon kind of, these are like carbon holds. They hold so much carbon in them, these mangroves, and they're so important. They're so beautiful. They're so magical. So part of it was about bringing light to the aesthetic of country, that it is incredibly beautiful where we are. And if we can just actually fight for what is left remaining and stop valuing things that are superficial and kind of really surface. A lot of architecture is surface scratching. So what we were asking architects, and that's not necessarily the result of architects. Often it's just builders. There's just short-sighted building project. These people who design them aren't necessarily architects. And this kind of discipline of thinking about space and time and relationality and good design is so important globally for everyone to really think about what is sustainable, what is just, and how will we see ourselves and each other in these spaces. The permeate film, we also worked with Kaurna community who are reviving the string making technique, which takes hours and hours to split these reeds and twist them. And then you can make these large fishing nets. And with those fishing nets, Kaurna community can, you can, it's like the slow food movement or whatever. This is like the slow net making movement. And then actually engaging with a living environment of like fishing, catching your fish, spending the whole day engaging with this kind of world. And it is incredibly beautiful to bear witness to. So for me, that was the honour of kind of hanging out on beautiful, in a beautiful spot, trying to protect that spot by bringing awareness to it and working with Kaurna community and how got the cultural revival that's going on in our communities, those important small movements, yeah.
Yeah, the parallels that you draw between colonialism, landscape, and mining share a relationship with mapping, and the exhibition also aims to draw attention to the role that mapping played by the British in overriding sort of some of that indigenous lands. But here you propose to demap these lands. Can you elaborate a bit on this concept and talk us through it?
So mapping, surveying, the casting of a kind of net of lines and control and power over the landscape is an integral part of colonial settlement. And it's also fundamental to the way architecture intersects with the challenge, the discourse of decolonization. This dimension of our thinking for the exhibition, we sought to think through and explore how mapping works to shape our understandings of space and to structure our occupation of space, and in a way to naturalize those understandings and occupations. The map is just kind of, you know, it has this kind of facticity about it. It's kind of like objectivity about it, which is, of course, very deceptive. So at the very start of any kind of spatial reckoning with decolonization and the historical overlays of successive occupation is the need to, in a way, unsettle, query, undermine, question that mapping procedure that has resulted in these kind of spatial facts. And so we sought to think through how we might do that, you know, in an engaging way in an exhibition such as this. Initially, we had a ambition to effectively make the floor of the pavilion, the exhibition space, effectively a map or a country, and to through maneuvers on the floor, the building it up and taking it away with various elements, to exemplify this idea of the layerings of occupation, the layerings of inhabitation on land, on country, and to do that with to problematize the mapping procedure in that way. It became we were unable to realize that goal for reasons of time and cost, unfortunately, but we retained the intent and a kind of evocation of that thinking through the production of these representations of the map or the unmap or the demap around both Queenstowns. We actually took historic maps, contemporary maps, as well as overlaying words, language from Indigenous languages for the First Nations. And so we linked to cosmology, so there were also star maps. So it was a range of information that constituted a kind of layering of the understanding of the world, successive understandings or intersecting understandings of the world, and then sought to, through a procedure of kind of distortion, hybridization, removal, erasure, to, in a way, dramatize that question of the mapping overlay, the problem and problematize that colonial construct of spatial knowledge. So ultimately, the way it manifests in the exhibition is as it actually kind of is folded up as space elements that you sit on. There's actually two bench seats that allow visitors to the show to take a seat and listen to the words through the headphones of the inhabitants that were interviewed. So it's in a way, it's almost subconscious. You're sitting on it. You're looking at the exhibition. You're attending consciously to these other things, but the map is there. What's underpinning you, underlying you. And then if you look down, you can see these words. You can see these grids. You can see these emblems of a historic map and of the topography and of the natural elements. So it represents a kind of artistic rendition of this much more kind of ramified idea of the importance of demapping our colonial inheritances. So it remains to be realized in a more expansive fashion, and you know, we would love to do that at some point.
Just to add to that as well, the fact that for Aboriginal peoples, the way country is understood perhaps through very complex stories of place that allow you to map it. So, for example, on Kaurna country, the public story of the coastline, and so this is the outward-facing Kaurna story. So there's very intimate parts of this story that were only known to Kaurna, and then there's a public version of the story which can be told by garner to all community, but also a kind of an understanding of how that coastline was formed. And when you know that story, you have a very sophisticated map of the place, because not only do you know all the names, but you know where to find water. And the relationship with water and whereabouts on that country you can go and where is safe to go, and the kinds of ways in which you need to behave when you attend those places. All of these are very carefully arranged in these very complex stories. And all over Aboriginal Australia, these stories exist of interconnected, intersecting understandings of place, which are a map. They are an incredibly beautiful and complex map that is physical, emotional. Some of these stories are thousands and thousands and thousands of years old. They've been retold and the core elements of them remain the same, but the teller and the way that we tell it might shift over generations. But it's still, I think, a very important kind of reflection when we're sitting on this particular type of cartography that came with Matthew Flinders, and I happened to work for that university, you know, named after this fellow who was credited with circumnavigating and mapping the whole circumference of the country, right? But at the same time, there are other maps and things that we are not properly acknowledging, and these aren't included in the architectural plans of place or the city plans, but in a sense they must be. So when you turn around and look at the tactics, what the community and the groups of architects that responded to this call for tactics that are decolonial, part of it is actually reconsidering how we plan and map time and space, you know. And so this connects in with these very complex kind of philosophical understandings and how we might start to incorporate some of those values into what we're seeing around us in cities.
And Ali, I see a lot of parallels with what you shared and what Sashaba Mappe, one of the co-curators of the South African Pavilion, shared in terms of their indigenous knowledge and how it enables a certain reading of the landscape itself, which sort of prompts the question of perhaps how you see your research and what you're proposing in this exhibition being applied outside of Australia. Because obviously on one level, the exhibition premise and what you're presenting focuses largely on the Australian context. But in fact, Australia shares this colonial history with 56 other countries through the Commonwealth, one of which is Canada, where I'm located. So I'd be curious, perhaps each one of you can share some of how you see your research and your work in this exhibition and how it could be applied outside of the Australian context.
The possibility of decolonization, the possibility of justice and sustainability is has to be not only located in specific country, so wherever you're actually living and engaging with the kind of resources of that place, the energy of that place, but also a kind of a defense of a complex whole, something that is very, very profoundly complex and whole. The whole planet needs to understand itself as something that is very, very big, but also small. We have global kinships. Indigenous peoples have always known this, that everything is connected, that we are interconnected in so many incredibly beautiful and complex ways, but also that unless we can think about our relationships not just to our nation states and our little suburban Torrens Title block, but to the broader responsibilities that we have to each other and to those living and non-living yet to emerge, that the planet, that the possibility of us persisting, we have to have those, I mean, in Western philosophy, they call them like wicked problems at the forefront of all of our very local work, at our very, you know, so for me, they apply like colonialism, which has tried to be universal in its application of knowledge and lots of forms of science, that culturally we must find these languages which are attuned to justice and what it means to be human, but also all of the other living and non-living places that have energy on the planet. And unless we can kind of really understand the, try to attend to the complexity of that, we're heading into something which is kind of terrifying. And for me, it's the these conversations make it less terrifying, because ultimately it is about the possibility, the creative possibility of us, our humanity, is really profound. And I think that, and the planet. And so for me, that is the kind of, I don't want to sit and not have the conversations and be terrified. I want us to kind of go into the heart of the problems, really sit in, with discomfort. And I talked about that when at the opening, I said, everyone needs to share the weight of this discomfort. If we're just going to try to be comfortable, because change requires discomfort, and we actually, either we plan for peaceful radical change or really violent change occurs, and it you know, around us, the planet will just shake us off. You know, we're all here, you know, and for me, it's about the most vulnerable people who will then suffer. That's the kind of bigger conversations that I think have come out, and it was really, and also the kind of, I guess, the redundancy of a lot of these narratives of nation. What really was evident to me in Venice as the last kind of these world expos, you know, this kind of like, here's one nation, here's another nation, is that they are redundant. Those narratives of nation, those symbols of nation, we have to be well past them, because it's actually, they're really superficial and often based on, violence and kind of exclusive, really not helpful. And so we need to be thinking much more globally.
I've just finished my PhD with Julian, was my supervisor, and it was exploring the idea of the island and what we can learn from that, really, and using Tasmania as the focus. It was a creative-based PhD. And what I drew from that was that being on an island is, you know, there's a great dependence, or there's a great self-reliance, resourcefulness, needing to draw on yourself and not being reliant on others. And also the idea that it's a microcosm, like we have this great, with the isolation, you have this connection and a great sort of sense of belonging to the place, and not belonging as in exclusion, but belonging as in a connection to nature and a respect for the world around you. So I feel as though the video work that I made is kind of an extension of that idea of the listening and the respect for the world around you, and you know, much of sort of building on what Ali was saying, you know, that the reason I brought that up was because Ireland, the Irish Pavilion, really resonated with me, because their pavilion was about islands and about, you know, what we can learn from living on an island. And so I think that while it's true that, you know, this sort of national identity is problematic, what you can learn from just drawing on your own self and your relationship with your network and your community, and that sense of belonging that you can have, that shared, that collective idea of being in a place and respecting others, I think you can learn a lot from that.
Ali mentioned we need maybe to resuscitate languages for caring and understanding our embedding among the wide and deep community of living things and of our ecological and natural worlds. And I think what we have aimed to do with the exhibition's what I call the operative component of the exhibition is to start building the seeds of a language of spatial practice that architects, landscape architects, planners, just people shaping the environment can begin to deploy and work with to, in a way, get beyond, you know, our received ways of doing things that have led to this impasse. Ultimately, Venice is an architecture exhibition. The professional discourse that it contributes most to is the discourse of architecture. So we aim to produce a kind of inventory, or a kind of archive is the word we use, an archive of ideas, individual specific ideas drawn from specific projects or from particular engagements from across the profession in our country, in Australia, but detach them from any effort to highlight author or even project, but link them really as networks of ideas and techniques. And out of that archive, this open archive, it's an open and expanding archive of ideas, potentially expanding, we start to construct a new language. The linguists have a way that they do this. In linguistics, if you want to describe a language, the first thing you do is you gather evidence of how the language is used. And that evidence base is called a corpus. And it consists of just conversations and usage of the language. And out of that corpus, a professional linguist, an expert, will construct a grammar. And the actual framework that forms the language as an object of knowledge in its own right. And this is the way that I see the capacity of this work that we've started to go beyond its specific context of Australia or any particular place into a shared discourse across the planet of our architectural brethren who are involved in shaping buildings and spaces. So I invite listeners to look this up. It's on the website for the exhibition. It's called the Open Archive. And in there you'll find 65 of these ideas. Each one has got an image and some words around it. And we in fact distilled those 65 ideas. We kind of looked at them and looked at what their common points and their linkages were. And we kind of distilled them down to five key meanings or key ideas, key big ideas. And if I list them now, just so that the listeners can grasp those ideas, they are, in order, country, that is the world, the space, the land that we all live on. Country is a word that's very important for Australian First Nations cosmologies. Listening to all of those who we cohabit the world with. Then we have the idea of relationality, of apprehending the relations between things and people and places and to do them justice. Fourthly, narrative, to bring meaning to those relations and to places through the telling of linked stories. And finally, temporality. Temporality is the understanding of our engagement across time, through time, within time, in all of these lives and histories and stories that we are embedded within, and to bring that to bear upon our buildings and places.
That was Ali Baker, Julian Worrell, and Sarah Rhodes on Unsettling Queenstown, on view at the Australia Pavilion as part of the Venice Biennial of Architecture. Thank you for listening. Join us again for another episode of Talking Architecture.